Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Week, it's our practice to go around the room and introduce ourselves to each other. I'm Marvin Snow.
I'm Harry Wish.
Robert Chen.
I'm Carl Wolf.
I'm Gary.
Howard Deport.
Dan.
Say your name, sir.
Kay.
Aaron.
Bill.
Tom Pope.
What do you mean?
Ron.
Lee.
Bob.
Paul.
Chris.
Kevin.
Peter.
Jay.
Rich.
Marty.
Will.
Jerry.
Clark.
Jack.
Jim.
Clint.
Robert.
Peter.
Thomas.
Dean.
Paul.
Joe.
Dan.
Lee.
Mark.
Steve.
Eric.
Don.
David.
Ray.
George.
Cass.
Dax.
Stephen.
Harvey.
Scott.
Steve.
Steven.
David.
Harley.
Well, welcome, everybody. Is there anyone here for the first or second time, or somebody who's returned after a long absence? What's your name?
Oh, it's Scott Clark. I just missed my name a while ago.
Anyone else?
Yeah, Marvin, I'm going to introduce my friend Sally from Japan. Yesterday celebrated his 6 months anniversary here in the United States.
Welcome. We hope all the new people. We have someone else? Sure. Well, yes. Your name?
Stephen.
Stephen. Okay. Well, welcome all. As I mentioned earlier at the opening, we have a social hour or half hour afterwards, and we hope you'll stay and mingle with the people who have been here for a while. Okay. From time to time, Juliet interrupts the regular Dharma talks to have a very special kind of Dharma talk that's come to be called the Dharma Duo. And the duo this morning consists of Jim Christrup and Tom Bruin. And they're members of the Sangha, as all previous Dharma duos have been. And in the past, these presentations have been a real gift through the Sangha from the two speakers. They're prepared to tell us about their life's journey that has brought them to, through the years, to the point here where they're part of the Sangha at UBF. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Jim and Tom, and I'm not sure who's speaking first.
I'm going to start.
Okay.
Okay, I'm Jim Christrup. I lived in San Francisco for about 25 years. I've been coming to the GBF since, I'm guessing, the early 90s when they were over at the Zen Center on Page, of the Zen Hospice on Page Street, on and off. I've always been in, kind of in and out of here. I've never been like really super diligent about coming. So I guess I'll just tell you a little bit about my life journey, the spiritual aspects of it. And also, last week, over Thanksgiving week, I went on a week-long at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, a Vipassana retreat for 7 nights. And that was definitely an experience. Talk a little bit about that, too. Was raised Catholic. We moved around a lot. I think, you know, I work as a psychotherapist here in San Francisco. Also do part-time work over in the East Bay as a medical social worker with chronically ill elderly people. And I think one thing that psychotherapists and Buddhists often have in common is dysfunctional childhoods. And I don't think you go into either of these because you had like a really super healthy childhood. I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that, except to say, big family, Catholic family, grew up in suburbia, moved around a bit, my dad looking for, work advancement. So externally, everything looked fine in terms of, success of the greatest generation, World War II, came home, GI Bill, and got a house and a job and all that kind of stuff, raised a family in the beautiful looking suburbia. We moved about five or six different places. All the neighborhoods kind of looked the same. They were all new suburbs in different states. I was probably a pretty sensitive kid, emotionally sensitive, vulnerable, and gay. And grew up not feeling a lot of safety, not a lot of emotional safety, not a lot of emotional security or comfort, and pretty lonely a lot. Dad, alcoholic, mom, pretty codependent, some abuse and neglect issues. And so just grew up not feeling really secure, not feeling really comfortable in my own skin, not feeling like I really belonged anywhere. And initially as a kid, I really was into the Catholic Church. I remember falling asleep listening to Catholic Mass on my little AM radio, which was a new thing back then. I basically believed what I was told and went to parochial school for the early years, just first through fifth grade. And that was my reality. I believed it. And as I got into adolescence, I stopped believing it. I got angry at what I saw as hypocrisy, which I guess is what all adolescents do. But it just also didn't speak to me at all. I didn't connect with it as something that meant anything, that had any meaning. And I pretty much rejected all religion at that point. And went to grad school, moved to Oregon, moved down here in the early 80s. And in the early 80s, I got involved in a group of that did retreats up at Harbin Hot Springs. A friend of mine said, "Oh, there's this group that does these retreats at Harbin. They're meditation retreats, but you don't have to meditate. You can just go." And they were this TM group that I guess was basically the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they were all dressing up and having a great time, and it was fun. And it was Harbin Hot Springs, and this was a Catholic boy from the East Coast, so that was all lots of fun. And after going to a couple of those, I thought, well, maybe I should learn to meditate, because that's basically what they're doing up there. And Billy Graham, who was the Reverend Mother, and I guess was one of the founders of the Sisters, was a TM teacher. They had gotten disaffected with the TM movement because it was so homophobic at that time, and split off, and he started this retreat group of had some other TM teachers in it too who had gotten disaffected. They were basically told to just meditate out of your gayness. If you meditated enough, that would be left behind. And they tried that for a while and it didn't work. So I learned to meditate, got taught TM for free, do it twice a day, 20 minutes, and it actually started having a positive impact in my life. I was doing case management social work for a very dysfunctional organization in the East Bay at that point. It was very stressful, very bad morale, it made it better. It made it manageable. It calmed me down. You know, I'm not a person who shows stress externally a lot, but I do feel it a lot on the inside. And I would be all shaky and freaked out, and it just calmed me down. It made me more functional. It made my life better, made it more peaceful. And that group got decimated by AIDS in the 80s later on, and it eventually stopped having the retreats when Billy died, and got very ill and died. I was at that point kind of looking around, because I liked meditating and I liked the retreats, and what I was finding instead were Buddhist groups that were around. And there's some stuff that went in between there, like guru shopping with my boyfriend at the time, but I didn't quite take to the Hindu take on things. So got attracted to Thich Nhat Hanh. One of his books was reviewed in the Chronicle, I think, Being Peace. And I went and heard him speak at Stanford. He was giving a talk, and this was before he was like a big deal. I mean, a few people knew about him, but he wasn't like such a big figure. And went on a retreat with that group. I think it was a week long. I think it was at Mount Madonna, if I remember correctly. And it was very sweet, you know. A little bit kind of roping you in and then pushing the precepts, you know. But other than that, it was very sweet. By the time I went on the second retreat, though, it had gotten really big. The movement had gotten, you know, his following had gotten really big, and it was at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara. Nice spot. It was in the summer. It was another week long. But it was huge. There were thousands of people there. And I was sitting, you know, in the dining area having mindfulness verses, or gathas as he calls them, read over a bullhorn. Eating each step, you know, it was just, I am remembering. it was ridiculous. I can't do this. I just can't. So that it was, you know, there were some really nice parts of that week too, but I just couldn't deal with those kinds of crowds. I came to the GBF, I'm thinking again in the early 90s, and sometime in the 90s also got involved with a group of men that do silent retreats up near Occidental twice a year. Very informal, the GMMR, Gay Men's Meditation Retreat, is split off of the GMSR. And that's kind of mostly what I've been doing since then. You know, I haven't had a particular individual teacher or group that I've kept, you know, individual teacher-led sangha that I belong to. Also been involved in Al-Anon, which kind of balances out pretty nicely. I think there is some overlap between these groups. And that's been my practice pretty much. It's kind of gone through phases of more practicing more diligently and less diligently. Recently, my stress level had been escalating and my sleep had been getting worse. And my partner and I signed up for a 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction class, which is essentially Vipassana meditation practice minus the Buddhism. They kind of marketed it to like the health industry and hospitals and stuff, and the way to do that was to take the religious part out of it and just do the practice. So it was actually really, really helpful. I think partly just getting a regular practice going again, because that was part of the homework. You know, every day you would meditate or do yoga or qigong. And partly it was integrating the practice into your daily life. So having a mindful meal, taking 15 minutes and doing nothing. And I had never done that. I'd always been, okay, you do your meditation in the morning and that's it. Just that's done. And it seemed really powerful to try to bring it and integrate it into the rest of my life. So instead of working through my lunch, I went to the park and sat down and ate my lunch there. Wasn't doing paperwork, and watched the squirrels playing in the trees. And just those moments are very sweet and very nice. And just slowing down, you know, in traffic, just kind of watching myself in traffic and trying to take advantage of the backups rather than get angry that people are in my way and I can't get to where I'm going. I went to the Vipassana retreat at Spirit Rock. I hadn't done one there, and it's probably the most serious retreat I'd ever done. I think I probably stayed away because of that. The Thich Nhat Hanh retreats were more... well, there was a lot of talks, a lot of mindful walking, about zero quiet sitting, and some guided meditations. But it wasn't just sitting, you know. And this was 7 nights. And it seemed like I went through a lot of different layers in that retreat. The first thing that came up was just intense physical pain. Really, really bad pain. Right across my lower shoulder blade mostly. And like a solid band of just pain, ouch, ouch. So I'd be sitting, pain, 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 more pain. And then I started sitting, pain, aversion to pain, pain, aversion to pain. That actually helped to start to notice the aversion to the pain. And Wes Nisker, who was one of the teachers, suggested trying to feel into the fibers of the pain and also looking at the emotional level of what was happening with the pain. And I think... What was different about Vipassana from other kinds of meditation, because I did TM, which is mantra, and then I did Zazen, which was counting breaths. And Vipassana added awareness of sensation, awareness of thinking, awareness of sounds. But it also, which I didn't really get till I took this retreat, uses the mind to study the mind, which is kind of freaky. I wasn't quite getting how you were supposed to, because I'm so used to just, you know, just stay with the breath. So, but you know, you just pose questions and you kind of look at what comes up. So as I looked at the emotional component, it seemed like, you know, what had been going on since I got there was just trying to manage everything. You know, coming from an abusive childhood, I was always trying to manage stuff, to manage the world, to somehow make it not be too much. And I do that in a lot of ways. One of them is by looking at the clock a lot. You know, okay, 20 more minutes, I can make it through the next 5, and then I can make it through the next 10. How am I going to spend my time? What am I going to do in between? You know, all that. And I just saw all that managing and just released it a little. And another layer that came up under the managing was just, as I sat with it, was just fear. You know, underneath the trying to keep everything controlled, it was a lot of fear. Just terror. And I think, you know, part of the fear that was coming up now is having turned 50. You know, I'm just been having some health issues come up that don't resolve as quickly as things did when I was in my 30s or early 40s. And some of them are exacerbated by stress, which creates kind of this feedback loop, you know, health issue exacerbated by stress. It goes up a little bit. I get more stressed. And I just couldn't get out of that loop. You know, my mind would go twirly, twirly, twirly. And I was just looking, and, you know, and also being 50, you know, there's pretty much guaranteed you know, more time behind you than in front of you, you know. If I don't know if I'll live to 100, I don't know if I want to, but that's pretty clear too. So there was a lot of fear, and I just sat with the fear. One of the Dharma talks, they had talked about the I can't tell the story appropriately, but essentially it's about this demon or this troll that comes into the celestial kingdom, and the king of the celestial kingdom is absent, so the troll kind of forces his way in and sitting at the table, gobbling up all the food, drinking all the wine, being obnoxious, belching, farting, and all the other people in the kingdom are trying to throw him out, kick him out, and the more they try to throw him out and kick him out, the bigger he gets, the stronger he gets, the larger he gets, until he's like taking up the whole hall. And then the king comes back and he invites the guy to sit down, invites the troll, the giant troll, to sit down, offers him the best food, offers him the best wine, gives him attention, and as he does that, the troll shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. And that was essentially the approach I took to the fear. I just worked with sitting with the fear, staying with the fear, staying present with the fear, letting it be right here. I even visualized it being this troll and offering it food and drink and the best place and the good attention. And it actually did calm down. And got me to a much more open place, a much more tender place inside. And just having more of openness available to me and less of thinking. You know, just being able to access some openness in between the thinking. So it kind of got me in touch with that little guy that had put up all these defenses so long ago, you know, to protect himself, to keep himself safe. And basically, just wanted to be safe, to love. So there's all, you know, the similarity with psychotherapy and practice is this all these layers of defenses, all these layers of protection that just keeping you from basic who you are and from openness and from presence, just being present. A lot of differences too, but that's one of the similarities. Getting down to that core level, that organic place where you just are. So, I think I'll end with that. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Tom Bruin, and I want to thank Dean for encouraging me to do this. And it's a privilege to participate, whether I'm on a cushion out there or being up here, with a group of people who are on a spiritual path and discovery and all of that. This is a great environment, so I'm happy to participate. If you're ever asked to do this, I know for me the thought came up, well, who am I? What can I possibly offer? I've not been here as long as some of you. I've not been practicing Buddhism more than but a couple of years. And then it occurred to me that being asked to do this is like being asked to participate in a salary survey. You don't say, well, I don't make enough to participate in the survey. It's just a cross-section. So it's really to help us understand each other, get to know each other. And I think that's very valuable. I could probably spend an entire year out at tea trying to get to know all of you, but here I can do it all at once in some form or another, so I think that's... And any of you who know me, I'm quite likely to stick out my hand and say hello to a stranger unless they're wielding a knife. Even then, that's probably a really good way to disarm someone. Like Jim, I started off in the Catholic tradition by birthright, and my parents, although we lived in the same house, they still live in the same house I was born and raised in, so didn't have the variety of all that, and was very involved. I was an altar boy and, you know, a good one. was involved. I had a priest who was very formative in my thinking about participating and who I was and my ability to offer something, to get up and speak. I became a lector. I was reading from the Bible during the Mass. I was involved in the youth group and all that. He encouraged me to think of the gifts I could offer and to lead and all that. And coincidentally, over Thanksgiving, I was back in Phoenix, and I had a chance to meet him again after 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's a long time. I've been keeping up with his career. He went on to become the head of his order worldwide, the Croziers. And I started off in wildlife management because I really was attuned to nature and I wanted to get outdoors and see things. Well, he was in his order and ended up going to the Congo and Irian Jaya and Indonesia and, you know, all Brazil, all these different places. And if I'd known that when he was encouraging me to become a priest, I might have, you know, taken him up on it. But I didn't. I think some of the feelings that I was encountering as a teenager, confusion and uncertainty and all that, I interpreted at the time as, you know, maybe this calling that I should go into the priesthood. But I didn't do that. I'm not really sure why. I toyed with it a bit, but never really took it very far, and I'm actually quite thankful for that. Might have gotten myself in some trouble there, I don't know. So, I was involved in the Catholic Church. It was very dear to me. I like the ritual. I like, now that I look at it, if you've ever been to a Catholic Mass over and over and over, the words just flow out of your mouth after a while because it's the same. It's exactly the same over and over. And it's really a meditation because you can do it without really thinking about it. You stand up, sit down, kneel, you know, pray, recite, and it becomes very calming. And so in some regards, I miss that. Not too much. What really kept me in the Catholic Church, I was away for a while when I went to college, was away after I moved here to San Francisco for obvious, you know, political and dogmatic reasons. But I had this need to be around people for spirituality, and I started going to Most Holy Redeemer in the Castro, which is a really wonderful community of people, and that's what attracted me to it. So I was doing that, involved in outreach to runaway youth and homeless, and then Ratzinger was elected Pope Benedict, and it sort of told me that my hope for change internally within the church was kind of a long shot, because he'd been pulling the strings for probably the previous decade anyway, and I thought, well, it'll just be more of the same. So, you know, I had long been involved in the Catholic Church thinking, well, it's easier to change something from within than to just leave it and, you know, say goodbye to it. It's like I would say, well, I don't really like our government here oftentimes, but you don't see me moving to Canada or Mexico. And that argument held for a while until finally the scales tipped and I thought, you know what, there's so much I'm having to overlook to continue participating in this that it's best if I just walk away. And I did that a few years ago, but I started to feel this, you know, this emptiness. You take something out of your life and just rip it out, and if there's nothing there, you feel a void. So years before, I had written down a number of lifelong goals, one of which was to read and understand the Bible, read and understand the Quran, and understand the teachings of Buddha. Because I didn't think there was a Buddhist Bible. I didn't know what else to say. So, understand the teachings of Buddha. And then I think I was at the Castro Street Fair, and the Gay Men's Buddhist Sangha, sister organization, similar to ours here, had a booth, was doing outreach. I grabbed a flyer. It sat on my desk for about 6 months. And then I saw that they were doing this particular talk, so I went, and it was very appealing to me. this whole format, exact same format as this. So it was very appealing to me, and I started getting involved. And it occurred to me that it was the similar type of community of good people that I had been missing. People I could connect with who were, studying and growing and thinking and on a lifelong journey. Because I really consider that is what Buddhism is. It's a lifelong journey of self-discovery. And that was appealing to me. So that's kind of how I came to it. I really like the format that we have here because it allows me to sit in one place and there's this parade of teachers and people and ideas and outlook that just run right past all of us. So instead of having to run around and do guru shopping or look for different places, it's a great place to start. Or remain. I don't know. I don't know whether I will. I've heard some people say you really can't do it and explore, deepen your Buddhist practice unless you commit to a particular tradition and go with it. I don't know. We'll see. The one thing I like the most is the idea that you should try everything that you're taught, everything that you read. Try it out for yourself. See how it fits. Pull it on. If it doesn't fit, take it off and, try another piece. For those of, most of you who are here probably are attracted to that as well. It really forces us to think and to engage. Much more so than dogmatic principles laid out by traditional churches. And so I find that very appealing. I really like it. As far as what my... I will say this too. A great book, if you haven't read it, is Buddhism for Dummies. Because as I started to explore Buddhism, it's pretty broad. And there's all these numbers and this and that and the 88,000 and this and the 4 this and the 16 whatevers. And it's difficult to look at this big map and there's no pushpin that says you are here. So Buddhism for Dummies sort of did that for me. It was a little embarrassing having it up on my shelf, but once my ego got over that, it was okay. So I got a lot out of it. So today my practice is daily I take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And to me, taking refuge is not just something to cling to. It's a combination of reverence for what has been developed and presented and given freely, gratitude for that, and devotion to it. So when I say take refuge, it means just that. I find that very comforting. I meditate as well, try to meditate on a daily basis, but for me, it's not as consistent, and sometimes my meditation consists of reading. I'm very drawn to concepts and ideas of unity and the unity of the entire universe. Universe, one song, one, oneness of everything. And as I look around the room, it's encouraging to think that we all have this commonality that bonds us together. So sometimes my meditation is reading. Scriptures, thoughts, things like that. I actually went on, knowing that I was going to do this talk, I took the opportunity to go on my first retreat, which was just a day-long city retreat. And I wasn't too thrilled with it, but I can say that I'm not retreatless. That would be so embarrassing. But what all of this has done for me, it has allowed me to settle my mind much more so than in the past. A few years ago, I went through a business bankruptcy for my business. And it's really tough. Part of the problem of getting there is, I think, denial along the way of how bad things can get. And, it's going to turn around. I can make it happen. It's just around the corner. And then finally getting to the realization that, it's not going to happen. And it's a tough blow. You know, it's a tough blow to the ego. And talk about trying to calm the mind. I mean, it's really, it's very difficult. Sleepless nights, wondering about the future. So not being present, you know. I think that's what got me there, was not being present, not being realistic at times. And it's what made it so difficult. So if you're ever, if you've ever gone through that, or you're in the process of losing your house or foreclosure, or, you know, in this market or something like that, meditation and centering your mind can really work wonders. My physical ailments went away, you know, once I was able to settle down. Of course, once the bankruptcy was over, that helped too. There's some relief that comes with that. I'm also feeling much more compassion. You know, I started off in wildlife management because I just felt this connection with living things. But in college, once I realized I would actually have to take and pass organic chemistry, and when I looked at the prospects for work, most of it was actually in law enforcement, game warden and, you know, fish and game and things like that. And that's not really what I wanted to do. So I switched to something quite similar and went into corporate finance. And figuring, well, if I really want to get outdoors and do these things, I'll just do that recreationally. So I was able to do that on somewhat of a limited basis. But it really, I think coming into Buddhism and exploring the ideas of compassion and loving kindness is what drove me to this year become vegetarian. Not just for the health, I mean, not really for the health aspects of it. I mean, I love a good ribeye now and then, used to. But the idea that of non-killing, of non-harming, of compassion, especially because of, I mean, just what I see is the toll that our modern meat production practices extract on, you know, the animals. So that's about it for the soapbox. But that's what it, that's where it brought me. Because it's my way of reducing suffering, not contributing to it. So, you know, the other aspect of of unity that I find in Buddhism is, of course, reincarnation. And many of us struggle with that, especially if we've come from, you know, a Christian background. The idea of multiple lives and getting it right over time is certainly not beneficial to the church. You know, you can't whip people into shape if they think they have forever. So reincarnation, I know, is something I still struggle with, but I think it's because sometimes we tend to think of it as ourself, you know, me, Tom, being reborn next as a woman or as a dog or something like that. And I don't really buy into that, which I think is perfectly in line with Buddhist teaching, that there is no discrete self that lives on and goes forward. I think there's this energy, this presence, probably the same thing that connects all of us right now, just sort of regroups and bubbles up in some other format. And thinking that way, that's where I'm privileged to participate in a Sangha, because it's a chance to see, you know, to look into someone else's eyes and recognize that we are joined in some way. So this is my chance to, participating with other people is my chance to celebrate being human, you know, this existence that I'm in right now. I enjoy art, but it occurs to me I don't produce much for other people to see. I love music, but you probably don't want to hear me sing. So participating in this and doing volunteerism and outreach and just serving others in any way I can, I think, is my opportunity, you know, to bring gifts. And this morning, I'm not sure why it happened, but this morning as I was walking out my door, I ran into the stranger was coming out the doorway next to me. And so I stuck out my hand and introduced myself, you know, said, we haven't met yet. And it turns out that he is a young composer whose work I really admire. I had heard a song of his, and in some ways it reminds me of reincarnation or this ongoing energy. And at the time that I heard it, it just moved me to tears. And so I shared that with him this morning. He was very, you know, grateful. So this person just, you know, popped into my life as I was coming over here. And I'd like you to read you the song that he wrote. It's based on the premise, what if the day one dies is a beautiful day? And his name is Jason Bush. He graduated with a master's in composition from San Francisco State. A beautiful day, the sun on the palms of my hands, soft warmth like a cloud, like love, enfolds me. My naked body, my naked soul, oh my soul. As I walk west past fields of the world you know, on a sparkling thread of ocean, extending far, far beyond the edge of the earth, where all is now just another echo in the vast collection of time. Here there is no war, nor despair. The corridor of the stars is now mine. In mighty company, my footsteps echo on this unending crystal silence. My heavenly march to the choir of angels. They're waiting for me. And I am you who are now comforted. So I was really happy to run into Jason this morning. And I told him that the reason I still had this was because I tucked it into a file that I keep that says my memorial. So, you know, when I hear songs and different things like that, hopefully it'll have meaning to someone else when they realize I have departed. But I'm happy to be here now with all of you. And thank you, Dean, for asking me to step up and do this.
Thank you, Bill. We do have some time for questions.
Thanks to both of you for sharing. You both talked about your initial growing up with the religion of Catholicism and coming to this as somewhat of a rejection in a way. And I think a lot of people come to this kind of practice not necessarily because they want to learn about all the sorts of shiny things to worship, but it's more of a mindfulness in this Western way of practicing Buddhism, sort of a self-improvement kind of approach. And I wondered, you talked about, Tom, about a lot of spiritual aspects of the interconnectedness that we all feel, and you talked about, Jim, about being in Al-Anon, where there's a sense of turning to a higher power. And I wondered how you both think about, if you'd be willing to share about how you think about this, some sort of concept of a higher power now in your lives.
That's a tough one. I'm not sure. I don't think of like, you know, old man with a beard or any kind of an embodied thing like that. I guess for me it comes closest to, like, you know, Taoism or the way, that there is some kind of an energy, there is some kind of a force for good and wholeness and lovingness. And the more I open up to that force in my life, the better my life is, and the more use I am to other people in the world, and the more I get stuck in my will about what I think I want and need to have to be happy, and the more closed down and contracted my life gets. So I think it's more of a force of openness, of lovingness that exists, and I can't really say anything more about it than that.
Yeah, I think for me also it's a realization that no matter what we try to define God as, or, you know, it's so limited. it's so limited for us to be able to conceive it. I'm very interested in quantum physics and, you know, what makes things happen. We know that molecules and the tiniest particles vibrate, and that's what causes things to feel solid. But what's the little energizer, you know, what's the battery inside of all that that makes everything continue to vibrate and wiggle and move? And I don't know, but I think it has certainly a great capacity to express itself, which is wondrous. You know, I mean, if you look at the variety of flowers on them, I mean, look at anything out in nature, and if you look at enough of it, I just have to feel that there's something behind it all. Did that answer your question?
Thanks.
Anyone else? Question?
Yeah. I don't quite know how to phrase this question. You talked about Ruth Thich Nhat Hanh, and they were pushing the precepts at you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you talked about the benefit of a practice that's helpful to you without the Buddhism in it. And here you are with us, a group that's self-identified as the Gay Buddhist Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean to you, Buddhism?
I think that the group, you know, that the mindfulness-based stress reduction, that was how they did it.
I understand, but yeah. Said, yes, but we got it, and it was good, and it wasn't there. You know.
There's still good okay. stuff in there. Yeah.
I've done the same thing teaching in the county jails, so I understand what you might have done, but yeah. If you comment about it.
Yeah, and I. Well, you know, I do follow a Buddhist practice, you know, and I do value the teachings, and I guess I think part of what the holdover from my Catholic upbringing is this kind of distaste for organized religion and for religious authority. So that's probably a lot of it is just my reaction to that. So, I don't know how exactly to answer it other than to say that I do follow Buddhist practice and it's important to me.
I certainly think you do myself. I mean, not a judgment, but it was nice to hear your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
How has GBF been most helpful to the both of you in your journey?
Most helpful.
Or most unhelpful.
I can say right off the bat, like being at Spirit Rock, it was wonderful organization, wonderful place. And it was a silent meditation, so I don't know for sure, but it was, you know, 90-95% straight, I believe. And it's just different being with a group of gay men. It just feels more like home. Yeah.
For me, were it not for this group and the Gay Men's Buddhist Sangha, I would have a much different view of the, quote, gay community, which I think is a misnomer. But it would lack depth. My view of, you know, gay men in San Francisco would lack depth. It has restored my confidence that, you know, not everyone just wants to go out to bars and do drugs and have sex and, you know, worry about getting old and, you know, stay shiny and that stuff. Yeah, it's helped me connect and appreciate what it means to, you know, to be gay and spiritual at the same time.
I'm just curious as to what your what the edge is that you guys are both working at the moment in your lives.
The edges?
Yeah. What's your sort of, what are you working with at the moment that's kind of most present for you, maybe in your personal life or in your spiritual practice?
I think for me, coming out of this retreat, it's like how to bring that openness into the world. It's very easy to be very open in an environment that totally supports that. But the first time I went back to my part-time social work job and had some very distressed person, you know, just from hello, just angry and hostile and wrathful and mean, you know, and here I am supposed to be the helper bee, right? It's really hard to hold that. It just really shook me up a lot, coming from that really peaceful, open, safe place to that in the world. So I guess the edge for me is how to bring that openness out more and in the world and still feel protected, still feel safe.
And for me, the groundedness that I feel with my practice is allowing me to explore a lot of things that might otherwise seem overwhelming. So in the past, you know, year or two, I've changed where I live, I've changed my relationships, I'm changing my mind, I'm changing my spiritual practice, I've changed my diet, I'm, you know, getting in better shape. I'm just really curious about what my capacity is in many different ways, and it's fun to explore that, and you know, the foundation that I have here helps me do that.
I'm Mark. I'm curious. I came from the Catholic tradition as well, and one of the things that I've struggled with Buddhism is that it can be terribly dry compared to the Catholic liturgy, and so I find that I miss music. I miss some of the other things from that tradition that aren't here. And I don't know if you struggle with this yourself, but is there a dryness? Do you ever experience this dryness with your practice in comparison to the Christian tradition? And if so, is there something that you've found in that difference? Or
yeah, no, I know what you mean. I do know what you mean. Yeah. I think, for me, I just don't rely on this to serve all my needs. You know, if I have a need for more music and, you know, that sort of thing, I find it somewhere else. I'll seek it out. And honestly, the idea of Buddhism that you have to engage and think about it and try it on and see how it is for yourself makes you be more engaged. Well, it's probably going to make you, for me, it makes me also aware of what it doesn't do for me, and that I have to go and seek out, as opposed to maybe a church that says, hey, just come here and we'll, you know, one-stop shopping.
Time for one more question. Maybe we any closing remarks? Do you have any closing remarks? Any remarks? Yeah.
There's one thing. One thing I forgot to mention that's part of my, you know, involvement with Sangha is a weekly book club, which has been very helpful to engage in and read Buddhist books on Buddhism in all aspects. We just finished a book called The Sutras of Abu Ghraib. Which notes of a conscientious objector who was in Iraq. Mm. But on the very last page, and I don't know the exact verse, but he quotes Buddha as saying, he who conquers himself conquers his mind, has accomplished more than all the armies on all the battlefields of the world.
When is your group?
Thursday nights.
Is that the one that's connected with the Gaiman Sangha?
Yes, Gaiman's Buddhist Sangha.
I had, this is from Thich Nhat Hanh, Five Remembrances, and this was came up in my mind over the retreat when I was like identifying the fears that were coming up inside of me and the fears I needed to face I will grow old, I cannot escape old age. I will die, I cannot escape death. I will get sick, I cannot escape the sickness that accompanies old age and dying. One day I will have to leave everything I cherish today and the people I love. I am a sole inheritor of my actions. I only take the fruit of my actions with me. So it's funny. Just being present with that and not running away when it's right in front of you is something. Something happens.
Well, thank you very much, Jim and Tom. Now's the time for an announcement. Anybody has an announcement?
Hi. Last week, Sean Fite was here, and he's doing a one-day retreat next Saturday at the Unitarian Church. And if you're interested, he's going to do chanting, he's going to do walking meditation, sitting meditation, and there's some flyers out next to the Bonneville. So if you've never done a retreat, here's a place to start.
Okay. Speaking of retreats and speaking of gay retreats, there's going to be a three-night residential retreat up at Saratoga Springs, which is really a beautiful, beautiful spot, a couple hours north of here, over Martin Luther King weekend. So it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights, breaking probably in the afternoon on Monday, starting, you know, late afternoon, early evening on Friday night. And it's going to be LGBT, and it's going to be led by a couple of experienced gay and lesbian Buddhist teachers, Larry Yang and Anushka Fernandapool, both of who have spoken here at the Sangha. And it's a great, great way to deepen our practice in the gay community. And so I think there's some flyers out there. If not, there's some in the car, in my car. I'll bring some out. And you can go on the Saratoga Springs website, too, and take a look at it. It's going to be a traditional Vipassana retreat, I think, sitting and walking and eating and Dharma talks. And so January, I think it's the 18th, 19th, and 20th. And the other thing is, there's another sitting group on Monday evenings at the center, at the LGBT Center, 5:30 to 6:30, same format as here, a little bit shorter, half-hour sit at 5:30, and then a talk at 6 at the Gay Center. It's a mixed group. It's a walk-in. Nice. Another alternative.
Yeah, well, a couple of weeks ago here, when we broke into groups, we did that once a month. I talk about a bunch of different issues, but one of them was community and stuff. That's an ongoing issue here. It's an ongoing issue for me, too, people know me. And one thing that came up was the sense that, I don't know if the word is frustration, but a sense that a lot of us, we only see each other on Sundays and only have a chance to talk and interact like half-hour social period after the talk and meditation. So I'm flirting with the idea of just having like a movie night, one night a month, like maybe the second Friday of the month, something like that. It wouldn't necessarily have to be like a Buddhist-related movie. Just a social thing. I don't want to take that on all by myself because that's kind of an obligation for one person. But if this is an idea that has some resonance, if people want to maybe participate in creating that, I think if we have like four or five people to take that on, then it wouldn't be an onerous burden for any one person. That would be a chance to have GPFers meet on a social basis once a month. And, maybe after the movie, go to a cafe or whatever. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, my name is Clint. You can talk to me outside, and then I can get names, we can further kind of discuss how we can make that happen.
Yeah.
Next week, we have a speaker whose name is Pam Weiss, and she's been here before. She's the very front and right speech, and she will be speaking on Dana, or generosity, which is one of the first of the 88,000 lists, list of 10 perfections. And Pam is a great speaker, and she's a life coach, so she always rolls in something that's kind of useful for you to go out and go away and work with. And she's a Zen practitioner and a Theravada and Insight practitioner, and she's now in the teacher training at Spirit Rock, and coincidentally married to Eugene Cash, who has a big sanger at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Sunday nights, which is another good sanger if you don't want to go to the Sunday afternoon with the gay men, or Monday with the gay men and the lesbians, or that's a mixed one. Thank you.
There is a sangha in East Bay that meets on Wednesday night at 21st and Broadway, and Larry Yang is kind of the teacher who comes there most often. He'll be there this coming Wednesday. So I don't have the address off the top of my head, but if anyone's interested, and I will email you, because they send an email out at the beginning of the week. Well, I have it on my phone. It's at 7.
You can also Google East Bay Meditation Center.
East Bay Meditation Center. Okay, yeah. So you can Google East Bay Meditation Center.
Just in terms of Sangha building, is it totally non sequitur if the GBF had a dance party?
Buddhists don't dance.
We're too dry for that.
Just to wet things up and sort of. You can tap dance. You can tap dance. Well, the response was overwhelming, I guess.
We have a host. Yes.
I'm your host. There's treats and there's tea. There's a donable outside, and if you could be generous, that would be great. And if you do drink any tea, if you could please wash your cup out.
There are no other announcements. We'll gather in a circle for it.
Power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity, without too much attachment or too much aversion, and live believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.